Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. December 7th, 1941 could have been just another quiet Sunday morning. Instead, Japanese fighter planes launched a surprise attack on the U.S. base in Pearl Harbor. The assault lasted less than 2 hours, but more than 2,400 people were killed, and the most powerful nation in the world was shocked beyond compare. President Franklin D. Roosevelt addressed the nation on December 8th.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
Roosevelt went on to declare war against Japan, bringing the U.S. into World War II. 75 years have passed since that attack, and the number of people who remember that day is dwindling quickly. Award-winning historian Craig Nelson has worked to preserve their stories in his new book. It's entitled Pearl Harbor, From Infamy to Greatness. Craig Nelson joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I know your book gets into a lot of detail about this, but for the sake of our listening audience, can you sort of summarize why did Japan attack the U.S. in this way?
Well, the Japanese were planning the most audacious military conquest in history. They were going to take over all of Southeast Asia from the Russian border of Kamchatka to the Indian border in the west. And in order to do that, the only military power standing in their way was our little Pacific fleet in Hawaii. We had 43,000 servicemen stationed in Hawaii. So it was something of a threat. But in fact, there was quite a bit of argument going on within the Japanese military over whether or not to attack the United States and add a new enemy to their list. They would be attacking the English. They would be attacking the French. And it was actually one man, Yamamoto, who insisted on doing this and threatened to quit twice if it wasn't done. So we really have him to thank for Pearl Harbor.
And Yamamoto lived in the United States for a time. I mean, he traveled its byways, its highways, its back roads, and that kind of a thing, right? Didn't he like the United States?
Yes, he was such an interesting character that he's probably the most written about Japanese man in American history. Because at the same time that he's insisting that if the Japanese go through with this plan of this gigantic invasion, that they must attack Pearl Harbor, he's telling them that they really should not do this invasion in the first place, and he's trying to talk them out of it. So he's constantly swinging back and forth between saying, you can't possibly take on all these people, you will die, you will not win a war with these people. But if you do start that war, you must decimate the Americans at Pearl Harbor.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the attack on Pearl Harbor 75 years ago on December 7th. My guest, historian and author, his new book is entitled Pearl Harbor, From Infamy to Greatness, Craig Nelson. Coming up later this hour, if you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. What was the U.S. image? What was the, let's first of all talk about what the average American's impression was of Japan, the Empire of Japan at that time before December 7th?
Well, they didn't really know anything about Japan, but what they did think was that they hated Japan because they were attacking the Chinese, who were our closest friends in Asia at that moment. It appeared to Americans that the Chinese were very much like Americans. They were hardworking, rural people, and they were on their way to a republic, and the Americans sort of thought of the Chinese as being like our little brothers, and that we could help them. Many Americans, including Henry Luce, the big media titan, had relatives who had worked as missionaries in China. Franklin Roosevelt's grandfather had made a lot of his money doing opium trading in China. And so there is a whole background history that we don't remember now. But when China was one of our closest friends, and the Japanese were viciously attacking the Chinese and committing war crimes across China, such as the notorious Rape of Nanking. So there was a lot of hatred there, but at the same time, Americans thought the Japanese were incompetent. They thought they were they couldn't make anything. They thought they were technologically incompetent. They thought they were physically incompetent. So there was sort of this combined thing of that they were this menace, but we didn't have to take them seriously.
And it's interesting the story you tell about why Japan thought it could pull this off. They'd already had some success against Russia in a war.
Well, the Japanese Navy had taken over, had achieved the first success of an Asian nation against a European nation many years earlier against Russia. In fact, President Teddy Roosevelt won a Nobel Peace Prize for negotiating the end of that war. And then they were on our side in World War I, in the Great War, and they got quite a bit of territory on that. But what really triggered this whole thing was the fact that the army for the Japanese government, China was like their Vietnam. It was this morass that they couldn't get out of. It was a war they couldn't win, but they couldn't admit defeat either. So they kept grasping at these other straws to try and justify what had happened and try and make a success out of this. And this huge takeover of territory was part of that.
And what the U.S. negotiated before Teddy Roosevelt won that Nobel Peace Prize for his work, wasn't necessarily that beneficial to Japan, right?
Well, there was a series of incidents that happened, beginning with Commodore Perry invading with gunboats and demanding they open their ports to our merchants and our whalers, where America and Britain combined to make the Japanese feel like second-class citizens. They felt like we disrespected them. They felt that we weren't treating them as equals, and they prepared a catalog of grievances. But by 1940, they were saying that the United States has the soul of a prostitute. So it went from allies to enemies pretty fast.
Japan had gone through major structural change culturally, governmentally in the 19th century, right?
Well, yes. They had a fantastic thing called the Meiji Revolution, which was done by Hirohito's grandfather, the Emperor Meiji, and he basically saw the shogunate's failings as a government, and he basically had the emperor take over the government and sort of imported every single advance from the West into Japan and then turned it over so the Japanese could profit from it. And it was quite a spectacular success. And if only Hirohito had had the strength and power of his grandfather, a very different story might have happened in the 1940s.
Pearl Harbor is such a huge chunk of history now. I mean, it's like Halloween. Everybody knows about Pearl Harbor, right? Tons has been written and recorded. And I was fascinated that you took on this effort now. Of course, it's the 75th anniversary. We always expect new things out at these kinds of times. But what did you learn that you didn't learn that had already been published, already been recorded?
Well, the big picture thing that we learned was that it was the Americans really thought the Japanese were this unified fascist force following one dictator and one sort of philosophy, just like the Nazis. They took everything they saw about the Nazis and applied it to the Japanese. And the Japanese were, in fact, not at all like the Nazis in the fact that their government was in complete disarray. And they had sort of lost their minds, where a very small group of military fascists had sort of put their finger on the lever of the government by assassinating civilian prime ministers. And they assassinated so many of them that they were actually able to intimidate the government into doing what they wanted. But at the same time, the Navy was fighting with the Army. The Army and the Navy were both fighting with the civilian government. And it was so chaotic that the government changed hands 15 times in 14 years. So it was just sort of, it was like a chicken with its head cut off. And there are many moments when the United States could have stepped in and dialed things back a little bit and achieved a peace treaty, but they just couldn't see it. They couldn't understand it. And the second thing that was amazing to learn on the sort of more personal level was the fact that so many of our greatest generation from World War II suffered from undiagnosed PTSD, and they were told to just get on with their lives and ignore it. And we actually had unbelievable thing looking at the oral history archives where you do not get any World War II memoirs or accounts in the 50s or the 60s or the 70s or the 80s. And then finally, around the 90s, it starts opening up because it took that long for these very young men and women to overcome this trauma and be able to talk. So a great deal of the new material in the book are first-person accounts from the people at Pearl Harbor.
What was it like to approach those kinds of interviews with people? They're number one, they're very elderly, but they also were traumatized.
Well, we were able to do a fantastic amount of background research before approaching the ones that we did, and that made it a lot easier because we were able to say, we know you went through this, and we know you did that, and we know you did this, and what else could you tell us? And so we were able to approach them as friends instead of as journalists trying to get the story. You know, we approached them as comrades, I guess, but sort of the really fantastic thing was, besides the military people who were there, was we ended up finding stories of people who had never been, whose voices had never really been heard before, such as Navy wives and their children who had to hide in a cave in Ford Island in the middle of the attack. And to learn about the Pearl Harbor attack from the perspective of a 14 and 16-year-old girl is an amazing, amazing thing to hear. And it really changed the whole story.
Because before that, we pretty much relied on what we were told by the government, right?
Well, you heard the official military accounts, such as, you know, squirrel rifles were not good defenses against Japanese state-of-the-art fighters. And you heard this sort of, and even to the point where, you know, one of the great moments to me is if you look at the headlines from the newspapers, from the American newspapers that come out the day after December 8th, you'll see that 300 died at Pearl Harbor because Roosevelt stepped in and told the press that if the real carnage was told, Americans would be disheartened and might lose their morale, and it would be giving succor to the enemy. So instead of 2,403, it was 300 who died at Pearl Harbor in the opening news accounts.
When did we finally, I say we, but when did the country finally learn the truth?
It was years. It was pretty much years later.
Wow.
There were so many people stationed there that the news did get back, but it was somewhat censored. So, but years later, as they returned home, they would tell what happened. But in fact, it took the Navy quite a while to actually finish its morbidity and mortality report, even to the fact that they didn't have all the names when they created the memorial in the 1960s.
And the memorial is an incredible place. It's where the Arizona sunk. You can still see the oil coming up from the bottom.
It's a really beautiful memorial. I'm so proud of what they did.
Yeah, it is very beautiful. My guest is Craig Nelson. He's an award-winning historian, author of a new book entitled Pearl Harbor, From Infamy to Greatness. We'll continue our conversation. If you have a question or comment for Craig Nelson, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I know Craig's always interested in hearing stories of the people who are there. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the history of the attack on Pearl Harbor 75 years ago, December 7th. Still with us is Craig Nelson. He's a award-winning historian and author of a new book entitled Pearl Harbor, From Infamy to Greatness. You want to have a question or comment? You can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Craig Nelson, what was America like in the months leading up to Pearl Harbor? What was going on at that time?
We were still rousing ourselves from the Great Depression, and a great deal of the sort of feeling about the country at that time was that we had ended the Great War, and with no benefit to the country at all, that the benefit of the Great War was completely to arms manufacturers and European royalty, and so why should we involve ourselves in that all over again? And so it wasn't until really the fall of France that people started in America started thinking we really needed to do something and we were going to have to be involved. But they had sort of starved the military. So that we were 14th in military power. We were behind Sweden. And most of our officers' field experience came from the Spanish-American War from 50 years earlier. And the common rifle, the common army rifle, was called a Springfield. It was from 1903. And it was really of no use in defending yourself against a state-of-the-art Japanese fighter.
Andy in Worthington, you're on the air with Craig Nelson. Hi, Andy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You were talking earlier about Roosevelt censoring the amount of casualties that occurred at Pearl Harbor. In that regard, or in that vein, to what extent was the attack on Pearl Harbor a complete surprise? Do you have any evidence that the United States was aware of the attack before it occurred?
Yeah, the only evidence we know of that said the Japanese were going to attack Hawaii came first in January 1941, almost a year ahead of time, when the ambassador to Tokyo from Peru told the ambassador to Tokyo from America that he had heard from numerous sources that if relationships between Japan and America went south, they would attack Pearl Harbor. And our ambassador told the State Department this, and it was ignored. But another great warning came in August 1941, when a fantastic man by the name of Dusan Popov appeared in the FBI offices because he wanted to tell Hoover that he had heard an incredible thing. Popov was a triple agent. He worked simultaneously for the military intelligence of the English, the Yugoslavs, and the Nazis. And he came to tell Hoover that the Nazis had hired him to do a survey of American defense strengths, and a third of the survey was about Pearl Harbor. But Hoover didn't believe a triple agent could be trusted, and he also knew that Popov was having an illicit affair with the French movie star Simone Simone, so he didn't believe him either. Those are our only two real warnings that the Japanese were going to attack Pearl Harbor, and the other things that people have heard about that they've promulgated are really circumstantial things that people didn't pick beforehand because they were like needles in haystacks.
Thanks, Andy, for that question. A really a good question, and also an obvious one. And it's interesting. Those, I mean, I get that they didn't necessarily, I get why they didn't trust. But, okay, then if you've heard that from a couple different people, why in the world do you put your entire naval defense in one place that has been at least rumored to be the target of a Japanese attack?
Well, we thought that having that level of armed forces would cow the Japanese away from attacking. And in fact, the military intelligence at the time before December 7th, they were afraid the Japanese were going to attack the Panama Canal.
Yeah.
And that was their worry. They felt certain that they were going to attack the Philippines. And part of the shock of this story is why, with 8 hours' notice, did the people in the Philippines not do anything either. So there was an entire attitude going on that the Japanese couldn't possibly. In fact, one of the great quotes from the work we did was finding the guy who was the head of Wheeler Air Base, which is one of the Army airfields that was attacked on the way to Pearl Harbor. And he said, I can't believe those little yellow bastards did this when everyone knows America is superior to Japan.
Yeah,
and pretty much that's what Kimmel, Admiral Kimmel, who was the head of the Navy in Hawaii at the time, admitted to his own lawyers during one of the congressional investigations. He said, I just can't believe they were capable of doing this.
The Japanese did embrace, obviously, this air warfare that wasn't very common at that point, although it had become, you know, the aerial battles from World War I are pretty famous, but the Japanese really embraced that.
Well, what the big revolution that they did at Pearl Harbor, as far as military technology goes, came in two ways. It was the first, the British had done something similar in attacking the Italian fleet at Taranto, but this was the first massive use of aircraft carriers to attack land. Part of the reason the Navy was so unprepared was because they couldn't imagine it. They thought if they went to war with Japan, war would be declared, and then the battleships would meet out on the ocean, and that would be the war. And so this came to them as a total surprise. But another thing Kimmel did not expect was them to be able to use torpedoes because Pearl Harbor water was so shallow. And they were able to use torpedoes because an American naval aviator, Bradley Fisk, had come up with a patented technique where they, and they read about this in the, from the U.S. patents and got it from them, where they came diving in and then they dropped these torpedoes that had these fins, wooden fins attached, that popped off and so slowed the torpedo dive. And they flew just like 12 feet above the water. And one of the aviators told us that when you dropped your torpedo and the water splashed on your wings, we knew we were too low. So that was a great, was an amazing thing to hear. But they would come within 1,500 yards of the target before pulling up. And many of them would have to pull up dramatically or else they would crash into the ship.
Richard in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Richard.
Hi. I would like to hear you talk about the fact that the U.S. aircraft carriers were not at Pearl Harbor. Where were they? Why were they not there? And comment on the fact that this was a tremendous tactical advantage to the United States as the war went on.
Going forward, right.
Well,
yeah.
It was a purely a wonderful coincidence because the Pacific War would have been delayed by quite a long time if we'd also lost our aircraft carriers. What happened was two of them were delivering planes to Wake and Guam, to the Marines stationed on Wake and Guam, because we assumed the Japanese would be attacking them and we needed to shore up their defenses. So that's what two of them were doing. And the third was back on the West Coast in San Diego being repaired. But the other great, amazing thing that happened that saved our ass at Pearl Harbor was the fact that the Japanese did not take out our petroleum tanks.
Yeah.
We had an incredible tank farm on Oahu because all of the petroleum that the great Navy used in the Pacific had to be tanked across the Pacific Ocean from the mainland to Hawaii, and they missed taking out that tank farm.
Did they miss it or did they not try for it?
Well, it was so they couldn't see it because it wrought so much devastation attacking the ships.
Okay. Richard, thanks a lot for that call. And Will in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Will.
Yes. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is a question on the life in the island and ethnic relations. You know, it's one of the quote, mistakes that were made that they lined the planes up so closely because they were so afraid of sabotage by locals and so forth, and that facilitated destroying a lot of planes on the ground. But what I was more interested in is, what were the relationships between Japanese Americans before and after the attack on the Hawaiian Islands? I mean, were they also sent to internment camps in the west of the U.S., or did there were just so many Japanese Americans there? I just wondered how that played out before and after the attack.
Yeah, that's interesting.
They were not sent to an internment camp. The entire internment camp thing was this horrible man named DeWitt, who was head of the Army for the West Coast, and he became hysterical. And he's the one who convinced the Army that they needed to do something, and the Army convinced Roosevelt. And no one, I think at that moment, there were 33,000 Japanese Americans living in Hawaii. It was something like 1/3 of the population. And in fact, Honolulu is still the most Japanese city outside of Japan to this day. But the people who ran the army there realized that they couldn't possibly intern all these people, and the economy would be devastated. So they only interned about 1,000, such as the people who worked in the Navy and the people who worked in, you know, the more direct government people, and they left the others alone. And those Japanese Americans ended up forming the most honored per-man unit in World War II. And in fact, in 1980, we granted them an additional 22 medals of honor. It's a fantastic story.
Thanks, Will, for that question. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Craig Nelson, author of a new book entitled Pearl Harbor, From Infamy to Greatness. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. We also take emails, allsides@wosu.org, or you can check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. That's really interesting. I've heard about that and that unit in the war and how highly decorated it was. I was surprised, though, that given the internment in California, that they even allowed them to form a unit.
Well, that it was all done. It was really based on the different opinions of the Army in the different parts of the United States. The Army in the West Coast, the guy was very hostile to the Japanese Americans, and in Hawaii, they were very like the Japanese Americans. So it was, and in fact, when we sent Japanese Americans to Europe, part of the thing that was so great, of course, was that the Germans thought they were their allies, so we were able to do a lot of sneaky things with them.
Take us to that day on December 7th, 1941. It was a Sunday morning in Hawaii, another beautiful day. I've been there. Every day's beautiful in Hawaii. You made the point, and I was not aware of this again, that all the enlisted men were the ones on the boats, on the ships. The higher-ups lived on land. They weren't harmed like the enlisted were.
Well, they weren't there.
Yeah.
So, so the average age, one of the things I found out that I thought was so interesting was that the median age for the 43,000 servicemen stationed on Oahu at that moment was 19. So you're already talking about an awful lot of young kids. But we think that at Pearl Harbor, it was much younger because senior officers were all living in houses and apartments on land. They weren't staying they weren't in dormitories at the airfields or living on the ships in the harbor. So we think the age group of Pearl Harbor was much younger. You know, you could enter the Navy at 16 and you could lie about it and get in at 15. So we're really talking about teenage boys, at least during the first attack. There was then a lull, and that's when the officers started arriving and started seeing what's happening. And then the second attack came.
And you write about the image of the Navy at that time was not a necessarily well thought of part of the military, and I was surprised. It was sort of the bottom feeder.
Well, sailors were known to have a lot of fun on their nights off.
Well, that's
So there was Eleanor Roosevelt made a quip about they had the cleanest bodies and the dirtiest minds. But my favorite was in Norfolk, which is now the site of the biggest naval station in the world. The city of Norfolk had signs in their parks: sailors and dogs keep off the grass. So it was pretty terrible. And one of the things, of course, in doing a book like this is trying to recreate as much as possible the life of someone. So I started with following one of the young survivors from the Arizona who enters the Navy, and he's shipped across to Hawaii, and he's so lonely, but he's so happy to have his three hots and a cot, as it was called, three meals and a cot, and the ice cream bar. You could get ice cream at any time from the Gedunk bar, and be paid $21 a month. But you know, we think of Hawaii as being such a paradise, but for many of these young boys, it was very lonely. They're away from their family, and each of these ships housed 12,000-15,000 men. So you're really ensconced in this metal city. And one of them told me he called everybody Arms because he couldn't remember anyone's name. Met so many people, he couldn't remember their name, so he called everybody Arms. It's an amazing thing. But to see, and these kids were so young. They had no idea Japan was going to attack. One of the great quotes was, I didn't even know they were sore at us.
Right. Oh, my gosh. Okay. Robert in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Robert.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Back in the 30s and 40s, Life magazine was a real popular weekly. And the week before Pearl Harbor was attacked, the cover of Life magazine showed a radar operator at Pearl Harbor looking at the screen, keeping an eye out, so we can all rest assured we won't be a victim of a sneak attack. I thought that was an amazing coincidence, and I wondered if your guest had any information on that.
Craig Nelson?
Well, one of the things that helped Britain and America win was our advanced radar. We had much better radar than the enemy. And there were, in fact, two direct warnings that happened in the hours before Pearl Harbor. The first one came with radar units that were installed at the northern ends of Oahu, and they picked up the incoming Japanese planes. But when they reported it, it was dismissed and ignored. And the Army never told... because the guy doing it assumed it was American planes coming in, and he didn't believe it. then the Navy, one of our destroyers in the pre-dawn hours, I think it was at 3 a.m., sank an enemy submarine. And he reported it, and that there, the Navy didn't believe him. And the Army didn't tell the Navy that it had seen these radar reports, and the Navy didn't tell the Army that they had sunk an enemy submarine, because the higher-ups didn't believe the on-the-ground people. The same thing happened in the State Department. Our ambassador to Japan kept saying over and over and over again, you can't back these people in the corner. Something's going to happen. You can't rely on us for information. And he was ignored, too.
Robert, thanks a lot for that call. Some people have speculated that they were all ignored because that's what Roosevelt wanted in order to trigger U.S. entry into World War II.
Well, there was no reason to trigger it because the majority of Americans were already ready to fight at that moment. They've been the majority switched to supporting the war after the fall of France in 1940. And so they were all ready to fight. And in fact, at any moment, the Nazi submarines in the Atlantic were going to take down a passenger ship. And once that had happened, the war would have begun. And in fact, Roosevelt spent an awful lot of time trying to keep what he called the wrong war and the wrong version at the wrong time from happening. And the only thing that he could have done better than what he did was more personally get involved with the negotiations with the Japanese. He left too much in the hands of Cordell Hull, and that's the only responsibility Franklin Roosevelt bears for Pearl Harbor.
We are talking about Pearl Harbor, the attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941. My guest is Craig Nelson. He's an award-winning historian. He's written a new book on the topic 75 years later. It's entitled Pearl Harbor, From Infamy to Greatness. We'll continue our conversations. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the history of how and why and what happened after Japan attacked Pearl Harbor. Still with us is historian and author Craig Nelson. His new book is entitled Pearl Harbor, From Infamy to Greatness. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. In an essay comparing the attack on Pearl Harbor with 9/11, Craig Nelson, you say that both cases reveal how very difficult it is to craft a defense against an enemy which has lost its mind. You also warn that that basic principle hasn't changed.
Yeah, I really think, you know, if you look at the fundamental reason Pearl Harbor was attacked, Yamamoto said, well, if we devastate Oahu, then the American citizen will give up the will to fight and will cede Asia to Japan. And that is the most insane idea. I mean, Americans, we like justice, you know. We're not going to have 2,400 Americans die and they'd say, oh, okay, never mind, forget about that. So it's a crazy idea. And, you know, the attack on 9/11 was, oh, well, if we attack the United States, Muslims around the world will join Al-Qaeda. And that didn't exactly happen either. So it's very difficult to prepare a defense when the assault comes from such a crazy idea.
Dean in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Dean.
How you doing?
Good.
Hey, I'm a pilot myself, but I've heard that the United States was putting them young in the cockpit back during that time. And I heard that Japan was putting them in the cockpit even younger. The guys that had...
Oops. Dean, we're losing you.
I just want to say about that, Dean, is the fact that Japan had been attacking the Chinese since 1931. So in December 1941, they had many, many hours of aerial battlefield experience, and the United States aviators had very little.
Okay.
And that was part of the amazing of the quid pro quo we launched against them with the Doolittle raid in April 1942, as the sort of tactical tack against them was we were able to drop bombs on the Japanese home islands. And it was amazing we were able to do that considering the lack of flight time our aviators had then.
Dean, thanks a lot for that call. Sorry we had a bad connection. We hear a lot about the whole Japanese kamikaze thing, but you write that not the Japanese that attacked Pearl Harbor that day, not all of them understood what they were doing at the time, and some were horribly remorseful afterward. What did you learn about them?
There's a fantastic story in all this that, you know, after spending so much time researching about the worst things human beings can do to each other, it was so incredible to find this one lovely story, which is that one of the biggest of the dive bombers attacking Pearl Harbor was a man named Zenji Abe. And after the war, when he found out that Japan had not officially declared war before Pearl Harbor, he thought this was a disgrace. And he made it sort of his life's mission to travel across Japan and get the aviators who attacked Pearl Harbor to sign a letter of apology. And after doing this, I think it took him 10 years, he then appeared at the Atlanta home of one of the Pearl Harbor Survivor Association members to give him the letter. And the man saw Abe and heard about the letter and told him he could stick it where the sun don't shine and slam the door in his face. But Abe wouldn't give up. And he started attending reunions on December 7th in Hawaii with some other men that he convinced to go with him. And they finally sort of broke through with a man from the West Virginia named Richard Fisk. And Fisk had not only survived for Pearl Harbor, he was a Marine, and he had survived Iwo Jima, which he called 36 straight days of Pearl Harbor. And so he, at that moment, hated Japanese so much that he couldn't see Japanese writing or sushi or anything without becoming violently ill. But when he saw these little old men begging to be forgiven, something in him broke down, and he just started hugging them, and he developed a relationship with Abe where he would go to the Arizona Memorial and play taps in both Japanese and in the American versions and present two roses, which Abe financed as a sort of token of his appreciation. And finally, on his last reunion, a Japanese man came up to him to apologize him. They said, "You don't need to apologize. We were soldiers doing our duty. And besides, my daughter married a Japanese boy, so what can I do?"
How many Japanese were lost that day?
Oh, I don't know off the top of my head. You can look it up on your phone.
My Googler?
Yeah.
But not very many?
Yeah, no, I think it's something like 29.
Okay.
It was 2,403 Americans died, and over 1,800 were injured, and I think it's something like 29 Japanese were lost. And something like 1,100 died in the one explosion on the Arizona, and that was the largest loss of life from one strike until Hiroshima.
Tom in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I had a neighbor, he lived three houses down from me, and he just died. He was 18, and he was on the California. He and his brother, and he was a communications clerk, and was almost killed by various bullets coming through the shack. And then it got too bad and too hot, so he and his brother didn't jump off the California. They climbed down the rope, and they were in the water for a while, and they were picked up, and they thought they were going to be taken to land. And what he did is spend all of the morning picking up the dead sailors and the wounded, and then taking them to shore. And he had all kinds of stories to tell me, and it was real interesting. And he ended up working for Admiral Nimitz, an underground secret place where they worked right off the shore there. And he was top secret at the time, and for 4 years he worked for Admiral Nimitz. Were you ever familiar with any underground communications that we had there at all?
I'm familiar with Rochefort and what was being done to crack the Japanese codes, which led to our victory at Midway. And I assume that's what he's meaning, but I'm not sure what else it could mean. One of the most incredible stories was one of the men who, like your neighbor, helped to clean up the dead. And in fact, he went aboard the Arizona to bag the dust. And his name was Sterling Cale. And I'm very love this story because I think many of the men, women from that time were traumatized and they got no help. But Sterling Cale, 6 years after Pearl Harbor, is on the beach, and he's got a two-year-old little boy, and they're having a beautiful day at the beach, and suddenly a rogue wave rears up and pulls the little boy into the water, and Mr. Cale goes running to save his son, but the minute the water hits his feet, he's frozen and nauseated and can't move because he's so traumatized by what had happened to him the last time he was in the water was December 7th.
And you said a dog...
So thank God the family owned a canine corpette who saved the little boy out of the water. But that was the last time Mr. Cale could even walk along a beach. He was so traumatized by what had happened.
Thanks a lot, Tom, for that call. I'm turning now to Joe in Columbus. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking the call, and thank you so much for your guest, for all of the work and research you have done. Sort of two parts to this question. One, in doing the research for this particular book, I'm wondering what you found surprising or if you gleaned any new information that you hadn't previously known. And the second part of that is, what lessons do you think that we can take from the work that you have done in terms of international relations and the United States today?
Well, the big surprise to me was the fact that the Army and Navy tell Roosevelt and his Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, for a period of 2 years that the Japanese would never attack Hawaii, that it's the Gibraltar of the Pacific, that we have 43,000 men stationed there, that it's impregnable, that it would never happen. And this sort of attitude that they have, that the Japanese would never attack us, makes Hull and Roosevelt act sort of belligerent in their negotiations. And there are many people in the Roosevelt cabinet, like Henry Stimson, says the only way to get Japanese to behave is to be tough with them. I know the Asiatic mind. And so there's this entire sort of idea that we're going to be tough and rough and da-da-da-da-da. And in fact, there's no way that the military could have imagined. And there's another moment where military intelligence presents a presentation at the Department of Ordnance explaining how the Japanese have better torpedoes than we have. They have a better fighter plane than us. They have all these years of experience in battle in China. They're really top notch. And as the guy's describing all this, people start chuckling. And he goes, "What are you laughing about?" And they go, "You're talking about those funny little people." So we had such disdain for the Japanese that we just didn't see any of this coming, and we were really completely blind to it. And that's what, you know, you can't say, well, Kimmel didn't do a good job protecting Hawaii, but almost anyone in his position would have had the same reaction because they were so blind to that. And we just can't be blind to people who are mad at us in the future.
Thanks, Joe, for that question. I'm turning now to Mary in Lancaster. Hi, Mary. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I was listening to your program, and I wanted to call in to say that my dad was flying over Pearl Harbor when it was attacked.
Flying in a commercial flight or in the military?
He was stationed on the Enterprise,
yeah.
I think it was. Well, he was flying with his mate, and he said a lot of times they burned the sugar cane, so when they saw all the smoke, he thought it was just the sugar cane they were burning, and it wasn't until they were actually fired upon that he realized that they were under attack. So they went and landed, I guess, on some island, took the gun off of the plane, and were there for like a day until they found out that Pearl Harbor was under attack. He was also I think it was Lieutenant Dickinson who wrote "God is My Co-Pilot." Well, my dad was his gunner, and he had been shot down two or three times, and he was in the Battle of Midway, but he had a lot of different stories. He was even in a comic book, I guess, because at the time, because he'd been shot down so many times and survived, you know, he was like not a hero, but people knew of Joe DeLuca. Just thought I'd call.
Is this your dad, Joe DeLuca?
He may be in the book. He may be in the book. I don't have a copy with me, but that whole story is in the book. And the story of the Enterprise, there's two groups of of pilots. One are the arriving B-17 Flying Fortresses. They have to set down being fired upon by the Japanese from the back and by the Americans from the front. And then the Enterprise sends its SBD planes to land on Ford Island, and they have to set down being attacked front and back. It's a hair-raising story, but the sugarcane story and Mr. Dickinson and all that is in the book, so your father may be in it.
Okay, Mary, thanks a lot for that call. Once again, the name of the book is Pearl Harbor, From Infamy to Greatness. Jim in Upper Arlington, you're on the air. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Ann. I'm enjoying the conversation. Thanks. My dad graduated from high school in Cleveland, Ohio, and immediately joined up. As a matter of fact, he skipped his graduation to join the Army in 42. And he went straight to Schofield Barracks on Oahu. But he graduated as a finished carpenter from the trade school that he attended in Cleveland. So he pretty much got stuck on the island doing all this rebuild work, building up barracks and offices and putting everything back together again. And as many times as he applied for active duty, he got turned down because of the need for his skill. But my dad was a prolific amateur photographer, and I have books of the encampment, and he also traded photographs with a lot of sailors and a lot of men, a lot of Army guys, who the week after the attack on December 7th had extra photographs, and they're now in my dad's books, of which I'm the keeper.
Wow.
So it's real interesting to see these photographs, you know, from just a week after the attack.
Well, your father was a great hero to me, because one of the incredible things I discovered was how men like him rebuilt the Navy and the Army on Oahu at such incredible speed and with such fantastic ability that they restored all but three of the ships sunk at Pearl Harbor. And they restored the Navy, the Army as well. So your father is a hero to me, and I want to thank you and for that story, because they're the unsung heroes of Pearl Harbor to me.
Thanks, Jim, for that call. We're just about out of time. And, you know, I think one of your favorite parts of doing all of this is one of my favorite parts of studying history, and that's the what ifs. What if Pearl Harbor had not happened?
Well, I'm really convinced that Pearl Harbor made America fight in two oceans and three continents and become the global superpower it is today. That if it hadn't been for Pearl Harbor, we would have entered World War II as England's little brother, just as we did World War I, and we may have returned to being the America we were in 1940 before all this happened. But instead, we helped create the United Nations, we created our immense State Department and Foreign Service, we created our enormous military, we created nuclear weapons, we created our expansive intelligence agencies, and for all the double edge of those swords, we haven't had World War III in 70 years. So I really think that Pearl Harbor and America's reaction to Pearl Harbor is an astonishing legacy, and that's why I called it From Infamy to Greatness.
It's kind of like building a muscle, right? It's sort of about breaking down the muscle first to make it stronger, and that's what Pearl Harbor did.
Right. Well, it's paradoxical that out of this horrible tragedy that destroys a huge part of our Navy, we then create the strongest Navy in the world.
You know, you did your best to find as many survivors and as many people that were there and remember it as you could. But it's been really interesting as well to hear from the children of survivors, the children like Jim from Upper Arlington, about the stories their parents tell as well.
Well, the Pearl Harbor Survivors Association disbanded, and it's essentially been replaced by the sons and daughters of the Pearl Harbor Survivor Association. And they were a fantastic group to work with in putting this together. I love them.
Well, Craig Nelson, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
It's been terrific.
It's Craig Nelson. He's an award-winning historian and the author of a new book. It's entitled Pearl Harbor, From Infamy to Greatness. December 7th will be the 75th anniversary of the bombing of Pearl Harbor. Thanks to the All Sides staff, what a week it's been. Producer Michael DeBonis, assistant producer Shyla Knott, my All Sides interns Walter Hopp, Jessica Shakespeare, and Shelby Powers. Video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla, and Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook. Follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me on Twitter too at Ann Fisher WOSU. Thanks again for listening. Thanks for all the great calls. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.